Number 15 is about the laws of thermodynamics. We saw the zeroth law. The first law was a law of energy conservation, in which case we had to account for things like the heat energy put into a system, the work done by the system, and the overall change in internal energy of the system. And so we saw some examples of that. We're now about to start the second law of thermodynamics. We are not going to do section 5.6. This is actually 5.7. So, second law of thermodynamics. Second law of thermodynamics essentially says that we know that heat can flow spontaneously from hot to cold, but it does not flow spontaneously from cold objects to hot objects. Okay. That's the idea. So if I have my hot coffee sitting on the counter, I do not in a half hour that it'll be hotter. Okay, sitting in this room. Okay. All right, so that's the basic second law of thermodynamics, but that's not the only way to state the second law of thermodynamics. There are several other ways that we can state the law, equivalent ways of stating the law of the second law of thermodynamics, and we will look at several of these. First is going to be in terms of what are known as heat engines. So we're going to start off talking about heat engines for a bit. Historically, this is what people actually dealt with in thinking about heat energy and trying to figure out how much work was available, how much energy was available for doing work. So worrying about the engines and things like that was quite popular in the 1800s. And well, at least 1700s, 1800s, people were considering these things. So what is a heat engine? A heat engine is a device for converting heat energy mechanical energy. Or basically a device that uses heat energy to do work. That's where mechanical energy comes in. Alright? So I have one such representation here of a heat engine. All right, this is basically the idea of a steam engine. While this is a little bit complicated looking, and we're going to reduce it to its most basic form in a few minutes. So let's think about what we have here. First off, we have a boiler. Right, which we operate at some high temperature. This is supposed to represent boiling water. Right, here we have some water. The water becomes gas. Here goes the gas, right? We have steam. And this steam comes along from the boiler through some pipes, okay, into a chamber. Okay, so what we have here is an intake valve, which somehow controls the flow. We have another valve here at the other end, and the idea is that the volume of steam builds up in this chamber. It pushes on a piston. Of course, as it pushes on the piston moves. The piston does work, right? So this gets attached to something, and it actually causes a force applied through a distance in some respect, right? Or you could connect it to some crank and make something rotate, whatever. Okay, then all the steam comes in here into the condenser, in which case you have coils or something, I don't know, freon, something out there which will take some of the heat energy left. Okay, and the steam, some of the stuff that was not done, used to do work, converts it to water, and then we have a pump at the other end that pumps the water back into the boiler, and we go through the cycle again. So usually engines can be represented as various types of cycles involving different processes. Okay, so that's the basic idea. What do we want to do? We want to take and make this simpler looking. Okay, there's a lot going on. So first thing to notice is that the boiler is operating at some high temperature. Okay, very often what we have is an abundant supply of heat energy at some high temperature. We're going to call this the hot reservoir. And down here, this will be the cold reservoir. And what the heat engine is going to do is going to take heat out of the fire, put it into my system, right? Some of that is going to go to do work. So the idea is that I have the engine going to take a certain amount of heat energy at the hot reservoir, and it is going to produce work. But there's still a bit of energy left from the original amount of energy, so we've got to cool off that steam, turn it into water. So down here, I've got to worry about taking some heat energy out at the cold end. And like I said, that's a fairly complicated looking diagram. So we're going to do a regular schematic of this, get rid of a lot of the detail. So our typical heat engine is going to look like this. We're going to compress our heat engine down to the following. Circle. Alright, this is my heat engine. Alright, gotten a lot out of that. But the heat engine operates between two reservoirs, a hot reservoir and a cold reservoir. So we're going to put the hot reservoir in here. We're going to put the cold reservoir down here. And the idea is that the heat engine is going to take heat energy from the hot reservoir. So we have heat energy. Call that QH for the energy from the hot reservoir. And it's going to do work. So some of that energy we start with is going to go off into work. And some of the energy that was not used for work, the leftover energy will be exhausted into the cold reservoir. And so I just shrunk this big ugly diagram, which is more of the real world, into a smaller picture. So a heat engine is going to take heat energy and convert it to work. Okay? But as we'll see, this heat energy cannot be 100% efficient. Okay, 100% efficiency means what? What you put in is what you get out, or what you get out is what you put in, right? So, in this case, whatever I take out of here, if I could convert all that to work, then I've got a pretty efficient engine. All right, there's basically no loss. QC here essentially represents some loss. We're going to find out that another formulation of the second law of thermodynamics is that there are no perfect engines. There are no 100% efficient engines. So that's where we are headed And you can see why people were interested in things like this, right? Trying to build better engines, all right? Trying to get more efficient engines and then wondering, well, what's the best we can do? Well, in physics we find out that the best we can do may not be as good as you think. As we'll see. All right, so here's our heat engine. Now we're going to look at this as a heat engine. A couple things to note is that I've already taken into consideration some kind of energy accounting, right? Some kind of conservation. We've noted here that the amount of energy I have to start is equal to the work plus Qc exhaust, the energy given off the total reservoir. All right, so I've accounted for all the heat energy. Here. Right, as I said, if I don't throw any away, then it's a perfect engine. Okay. So that much we know. What I did notice is that efficiency is pretty important. So let's look at the efficiency of an engine. Designate the efficiency with the letter E. E for efficiency. Sometimes they use epsilon. Okay. So what is the efficiency? Well, how would I know how efficient I am? Okay. I have a certain amount of input, QH, a certain output. So the efficiency is essentially the ratio of the output to the input. Okay. So let's write. That's the way you want to think about that. How efficient am I? Output to input. Okay, what percentage, what do I get out compared to what I put in? Okay, and that's basically the efficiency. Usually it's expressed as a percentage. Some textbooks like to write times 100% to remind you that you usually take that fraction and convert it to a percentage. Okay, so what is my output in this case? W. What's the input? QH. So the efficiency of an engine is W over QH expressed as a percentage. Okay. Well, that's not bad. Of course, we're going to need another form at some point. So we'll note that I can rewrite this if I use the conservation of these heat energies, I could rewrite W in just in terms of heat energies. So come over to this basic equation right here. Solve that for W. W is equal to basically QH minus QC. So in typical examples, you may be given QH and QC and not W. Okay, and maybe that's. All right, so we have, that's what W is. So let's rewrite the efficiency. The efficiency is W over QH. W is QH minus QC divided by QH. I can divide QH into both terms. So QH into QH is what? And QH into QC. So the efficiency we'll also see written in this form in terms of the heat energies, not in terms of the work. Right, so there are two different ways that we could get at this. And we'll see that this actually could be a bit useful later. So let's look at a simple example. Let's say I have a heat engine extracts, I don't know, 1,500 joules from a hot reservoir. Exhaust Okay, how much work was done? So how much work was done in this case? 1,500 joules was extracted, 300 was lost, so the amount of work that was done is just the difference. 1,500 minus 300 is 1,200 joules. Okay, what's the efficiency? Well, since I've got everything at my disposal, I could use either formula I wanted, right? So the efficiency is the output divided by the input. W is 1,200. QH, what was that? 1,500? Zeros go out. 12 over 15 is what? 4/5? 4/8? All right. And 0.8 is 80%. So, do you think that's an efficient engine? No. You really don't have anything to base it on, do you? Sounds pretty good, 80%. We'll probably find out that we may not be able to do that physically. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much what a heat engine looks like. As I said, what people were interested in was not just the efficiency, but what was the best an engine can do. All right, there are some physical limits on how good your heat engine can be. As I said before, there is no perfect heat engine. That's another form of the second law. So you cannot have a 100% efficient engine. So what's the best that we can expect? What's the best we can do? So we go back, and there are several people working on these things, and one person's name that comes up in our text is Carnot. Another person involved in this was Lord Kelvin. Okay, so we have different perspectives. Carnot, came up with a principle. And so Carnot was born right before the 1800s. He didn't live that long, I guess. Probably about 1832 or something. But Carnot's principle says the following, that essentially the best you can do, right, the maximum efficiency can be gotten out of using reversible engines. Okay. First then we have to tell you what a reversible engine is. Alright. So let's see if we write out the principle. An irreversible engines operating between two constant temperatures cannot have greater efficiency than a reversible engine. Operating Okay, so actually that's part of Carnot's principle. Okay. These are a couple of terms we have to define. So if it says here that if I have an engine that's irreversible, it's not going to have as good an efficiency necessarily as a reversible engine. In particular, all reversible engines operating between these temperatures have the same efficiency. So now we want to make sense out of what this says. Okay, so let's see. An irreversible engine, well, what is that? Operating between two constant temperature reservoirs. Well, we've seen what we mean by two constant temperature reservoirs. We have two hot reservoir and a cold reservoir. This is just saying that the hot reservoir stays. Right, basically, a reservoir is a big source of heat energy, right? Take any heat energy out of my hot reservoir, it doesn't notice it much, right? Put the heat energy into the cold reservoir, it doesn't notice it much, okay? So we know about, that makes sense, right? They cannot have greater efficiency. Well, we know what efficiency is. Than a reversible engine. Now, basically, we have to know what's an irreversible engine, what's a reversible engine. A reversible engine is very simply an engine whose thermal processes that it uses are reversible.
That didn't tell you anything.
Is that like a catalytic converter principle?
No.
Doesn't that reburn?
That's more of a catalytic converter is more of a reuse issue. Yeah, we can't grab the energy that's lost here and actually try to do more work. We're not going to gain anything. So. All right. Reversible engines. Use reversible processes. Alright, well, that, you were told not to define words in terms of themselves, right? So, what's a reversible process? Okay, essentially, a reversible process is a process that if I apply it and I go from state A to state B, I can reverse that process, go from B to A, and put everything back to its initial state. Okay, so that's essentially what reversible process. The reversible process is one that can be reversed to put the system and its surroundings back to their exact initial. So if I can build an engine with these different kind of processes, okay, we can do that. Now, what processes are we talking about, right? Do we see any thermal processes? Okay, in our particular engine here, we did have some process. We were extracting heat energy, we were doing work, we were putting out, right? We were giving off heat energy, etc. We can actually represent that cycle that we have as a cycle in a PV diagram. So, for example, the Carnot engine, just to give you an idea. Okay, there's an engine called the Carnot engine, in which it uses all reversible processes, certain types of processes. So if I went to a PV diagram, we could actually represent an engine, okay, with reversible processes and using some thermal processes. So I could start at some particular state, just like we did before. What do? We see some kind of an expansion. So what we could do is do an isothermal expansion, and then we can do an adiabatic expansion. So these are two expansions. This is isothermal. This is adiabatic. All right, so we can do adiabatic means there's no heat loss or transfer, but we do have an expansion. So isothermal is at the same temperature. So I could take my water at, say, at 100 degrees, turn it into steam, right, at 100 degrees, and we would get some expansion there, but it would be at 100 degrees. I could as well do something where there was no heat loss. Of course, you'd have to work pretty hard to have no heat loss in one of these real engines, right? And then, arrows on these. And then what I can do is I want to get the state to go back. So let's see. I can go back along another isothermal process and then come back along some adiabatic process and complete my cycle and start over again. As you go through here, you see that, right, this is expansion. You do work. This is compression. Right? The work is negative. Right? Q is equal to zero. You can take a look at the amounts of work that's being done, the change in the internal energy of the system, the amount of heat energy being given off or taken in. This would correspond to the hot reservoir. That would be the cold reservoir. And so you could look at this engine basically in the form we have here. All right? As long as these processes are reversible, what does that mean? If I go to the top state, we'll call that A, to the next one B, a reversible process is I ought to be able to go backwards from B to A, following that same path, and put everything back the way it was. Now, it's kind of hard to picture reversible processes, mostly because we live in a world in which there are too many irreversible processes. An irreversible process, of course, is one that's not reversible. And usually we can recognize irreversible processes very easily. All you have to do is take a picture of the process with a video camera, and after you take the picture, run it backwards. Okay, so for example, if I were looking at a movie and I saw a blob of water sitting on the table, and then the next thing I know, that water comes together and forms an ice cube, I smack my head. Wouldn't you? So the process of that ice melting, that's not reversible, is it, right? Just don't happen that way. You see some glass fly up on top of the table and then form a bowl or something, right? If you can run things backwards in time and they look weird, the chances are that's an irreversible process. So we can recognize those types of things very easily. Okay, irreversible process.
Are you losing any heat to, like, friction or anything in this process?
We need a reversible engine. All right, so we have some frictional losses in there, and chances are it's not reversible. So remember, a reversible engine is an ideal engine.
So it is perfect. It goes back to the beginning. It doesn't lose energy, therefore doesn't have no pressure.
Just like conservative forces don't. You know, I drop an object, right? Gains a certain amount of energy, goes back up, right? If I don't have any frictional losses, right? that's the ideal world, right? So, yeah, but don't use the word perfect there, because perfect engines has a different connotation. That's 100% efficient. That does not have, this is not saying 100% efficient. This is saying these are the engines that have the maximum efficiency. All right, so how do I determine what the maximum efficiency is? Okay, the idea is the following. Okay, I want to determine the maximum efficiency operating between two temperatures. So let's say that my hot reservoir has a fixed temperature. This says that my hot reservoir has to be at a constant temperature. So let's call that TH for T-hot. And let's say my cold reservoir has a fixed temperature TC for cold. And here's my engine. And as we noted, we have the engine operating between these different temperatures. Okay. If all reversible engines, which give me maximum efficiency operating between these two temperatures, are going to give me the same efficiency, then maybe the efficiency should just depend on the temperature. All right, so far, what does our efficiency depend upon? Well, the heat energy, right? QH coming out and QC going in, right? So here's my QH, there's my QC, there's W, same picture, I just put in pH and TC on my picture. So, for reversible engines, they should only depend upon the temperature of the reservoir. Okay, so let's introduce the following. Let's define a new temperature scale. Such that my efficiency can be written in terms of that scale. Namely, QC over QH is there. So let's define a scale such that QC over QH is equal to just the ratio of the temperatures. All right, so the amount of heat energy that's gotten out of this reservoir at TH should be related to that temperature. This is coming out. If these efficiencies are supposed to be the same for all reversible engines, then the efficiency should only depend upon the temperature. Of course, the simplest thing to do is to define a temperature scale, right? In which case, now, for engines that are reversible, so maybe I should put a little R on here to note that we're thinking right now about reversible engines, I would like to be able to say that what the maximum efficiency is. Well, in terms of this new temperature scale, my new representation of efficiency to give me the maximum value is just going to be 1 minus, well, instead of QC over 2H, TC over 1. So that's the maximum efficiency in terms of this new scale. I'm sure you guys are all toes saying, oh no, we've got 3 scales already. Now we've got to throw another one at us. Okay. Well, this other one, okay, I think we'll name after Lord Kelvin. Point is, that this new temperature scale that I'm introducing is actually the Kelvin scale. The ratio of the Kelvin temperatures is the ratio of QC over QH for reversible engines. Okay, so you can relax now, all right? So that you've got that. All right, so that's the maximum efficiency that you will get from any engine operating between two constant temperatures. So let's see. Let's pick some examples here. Actually, I've got some other numbers. Let's say I have a 650 Kelvin hot reservoir and a 350 Kelvin cold reservoir. And I would like to operate an engine between those. What's the maximum efficiency? What's TC? 50. The H is 650. Mm-hmm. 350 over 650 is a fraction. And then you just subtract that from 1, and you get what?
46%.
46%? Is that what I'm hearing? Is that very efficient? Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem efficient. So let's see, 650K, we're talking what? Over 300 degrees Celsius. Okay, 350K, it's not very hot, is it? Okay, we could reduce the 350K a little. Maybe we could bring it down to room temperature. Okay, make this 293. Put a 293 in here, and you'll find out you're not going to get it much more efficient. Okay, between normal operating temperatures that we experience around here, okay, we're going to find our efficiency numbers do not look anywhere like 80% like that example. Okay, could be a little surprising. All right, so the things to watch out for here is that this is the maximum efficiency. All right, I could come over here and say, all right, I've got a heat engine that's extracting 1,500 joules, exhaust 300 joules, and it's operating between 650K and 350K. That tells me I get 80%. This tells me I can only get 46%. So what does that tell you? That can't possibly be pulling your leg or something, right? So I didn't specify here what the temperatures were, so this doesn't mean this is completely out of whack. The question is, could I ever, you know, get 80%? You know, we could actually say, all right, if this were in a reversible engine, maybe what you can do is come over here and say, all right, if I know what the cold temperature is, maybe I could ask, what would the pH have to be to get the hottest temperature? If I, all right, how can I get 100% out of this? Is there any way that Emax could be 100%? TC would have to be what? Zero. If I put TC equal to zero, I get one, which is corresponds to 100%, right? So 0 degrees Kelvin, what's that? Absolute zero. Whole problem with absolute zero. Okay. The third law of thermodynamics, before I forget it. Basically says we can't reach absolute zero. Classical. There's other things that go on when we get down there involving quantum fluctuations and things like that, which can cause problems. But we're not doing any quantum simulation. So the basic idea is we can't get to absolute zero. So since we can't get to absolute zero, that's good. Otherwise, we might be able to violate the second law of thermodynamics by saying, I'll just operate my engine between absolute zero, and then I'll get 100% efficiency. And right, so the idea is that we will never have perfect engines. Along the same line as perfect engines, there's a section I don't spend too much time on. I mean, not perfect, but heat engines on refrigerators and heat pumps. Okay, for a refrigerator. A refrigerator is very similar to a heat engine. Okay? Think of a refrigerator as a heat engine running backwards. So the idea of a refrigerator is the following. Okay? It kind of looks like a heat engine. Refrigerator. What does a refrigerator do? Takes electricity and does what? Makes things cold?
Takes the heat out of everything.
Right. Takes the heat out of things, right? You take and put a warm soda in the refrigerator, right? You pull it out later, it's cold. Why? Because the refrigerator is taking energy out. Right? So we are taking heat energy from the cold reservoir, and we are pushing it into the hot reservoir. Of course, with this picture, what does that kind of looks like? I can actually take. If that refrigerator weren't there, that would be spontaneous flow from cold to hot, which is, of course, a violation of the second law. So in order for this to work properly, what I really need is I need work reversed as well. So we have QC, heat energy from the cold reservoir, heat energy into the hot reservoir, and we need to do work. We're not doing work, right? The system's not doing work, but we have to do work in reverse. Where's this work coming from? The
electrical power.
The electricity, right? You plug it in there, right? Plug it into the wall. So you got to plug it into the wall to get the refrigerator to work. Okay? We can understand the heat energy coming out of the food. Where does it go? Behind your refrigerator. Anybody been behind the refrigerator while it's running? Feel the heat coming out? Okay? So that's how a refrigerator works. You can talk about, again, the efficiency of refrigerators, right? You just ask, what is my input, what's the output, and what do we expect? Instead of quoting efficiency, they call it the coefficient of performance. But for the most part, that's what refrigerators do. Okay? All right, like I said, there were several ways to talk about the second law of thermodynamics. There's one way remaining, and that comes from the introduction of something called entropy. Okay, entropy is going to be essentially a measure of the ability to do work. And entropy is one of those things where you can have a bunch of different phases on it. And the entropy stems back essentially to looking at this reversible engine, right? Reversible engines operate on reversible processes. And look back at this relationship essentially and rewriting it. So we're going to start with QC over QH is TC over TH for reversible processes, which we just introduced in our study of engines. We can rewrite this, right? QC is the heat energy coming from a cold reservoir at constant temperature TC. QH was the energy, or actually put into it. The QH is the energy pulled out of the hot reservoir at a constant temperature TH. If I move things around a little bit, I could rewrite this as QC over TC is equal to QH over TH. Notice that Q over T at the cold reservoir is related to Q over H at the hot reservoir. So this quantity Q over T somehow has gotten into a physics world, and chemistry world as well, as something important. In fact, that's what we're going to define as the entropy. So for our entropy, we will use the letter S for entropy. The change in entropy of a particular part of a system as you are either extracting or adding energy at a constant temperature, and doing it reversibly is given by Q divided by T. So it's not just S equals Q over T, but it's a change in entropy. So in the case of our heat engine, like this one, I have a certain amount of heat energy being extracted at constant 650 K. So if I know what QH is here, divide that by 650, that is the entropy corresponding to that process.
What's the difference between that and power? Didn't we define Q over T as a...
This is
temperature.
This big T. The letters are starting to flow together, right? Okay. So the question was, what's this Q over time? No, it's Q over temperature. So there is a difference. What are the units? Q, typically in joules, temperature in Kelvin. So joules per Kelvin. Sometimes you'll see calories per Kelvin. Okay, because Q could also be in calories depending upon what units you have. Okay, so we can look at the change in entropy in different parts of the universe, right? Different pieces. What happens? Okay, so for example, I can have ice melting. We know how to compute Q for ice melting, right? And if we have ice melting at 0 degrees, I can compute the change in entropy for that ice melting. Okay, so that's the definition which stems from this. The question is, how is that tied to anything? Let's see. Just kind of do a couple of examples here. So let's look at my reversible engine problem. Here's my hot tap reservoir, a little cold reservoir. We have QH coming out of the hot, going into the cold. Okay, and we have a certain amount of work. So what do we... I don't want to find QC. Let's look at the change in entropy for the hot reservoir. Change in entropy. The change in entropy for the hot reservoir, let's call that change in entropy hot, is, again, it's just the amount of heat being extracted at that temperature. All right, it's going to be QH over TH. Okay. Now, what we have to do is pay attention to signs. Notice we weren't thinking about signs at all today, because most everything we're defining as magnitude. But now, we look at the reservoir. What's happening? Energy is leaving. Okay, so the change in the entropy in this case is going to be negative. Okay, heat energy is leaving, so basically it's minus QH corresponding to the energy that's leaving. What is the energy for the cold reservoir? The entropy for the cold reservoir, that's going to be QC over DC. In this case, we are gaining energy. So whenever you have a gain in energy, it's positive. When you have a loss, in this case, of heat energy, it's negative. Okay, so one can compute the change in entropy at these two different reservoirs. These are the operating of this engine. What if I wanted to know the total change? The total change is equal to what? Well, you just add these, right? So we look at the total change, and I have QC over TC plus a negative, which would be minus 2H over TH. So QC over TC minus QH over TH is the change in entropy due to the running of that engine. Okay? But if the engine's reversible, those two quantities are equal. Right. So if I'm using a reversible engine, this is equal to zero for a reversible engine. So one would normally say here that the change in the entropy of the universe is zero. The entropy has not changed. Okay, for reversible processes. Now that puts it a little different than if I don't have a reversible process. So we could do something spontaneous. Let's compute the change of entropy in the following situation. Let's take my 650K reservoir that I have there. And let's put in a 350K. And let's connect these two with a piece of copper or a piece of metal. Right? Metal conducts. So we can easily get some heat flow, okay, in this system. Okay? From the hot to the cold without using an engine. Let's assume that we have like 1,200 joules worth of heat that flows. Alright? So the heat energy that leaves the 650 is 1,200. The heat energy gained by the 350 is 1,200. Let's ask, what is the total change in entropy? So the total change in entropy would be the entropy change for the hot plus the entropy change for the cold. How do I get this hot entropy out of here? What is the entropy change for the hot reservoir?
Negative.
It's negative because it's a heat loss. What is the heat, the Q value for this?
1,200.
And the temperature is 650. Okay, let's add to that the entropy change at the cold reservoir. Again, all the entropy change is we just compute the heat flow at that constant temperature. Right? Dealing with nine constant temperatures is beyond our class. So, all right, what is the heat flow? Well, again, it's 1,200 joules divided by what's the temperature of the cold reservoir? 350. Each individual one undergoes a change in entropy, but if you add these together, the total effect on the whole universe, in this case the whole universe is just those two reservoirs, 1.6 what? Let's see, joule per Kelvin. Okay, now the key here is not that the 1.6 is important. The key here is that this is not a reversible process. I cannot connect that bar and expect to get this heat to flow back. Okay? This is greater than zero. It turns out that for irreversible processes, if I account for all the entropy changes, right, of the system and its surroundings and add them up, the change in entropy is positive. Alright? So the net change of entropy in the universe actually is continuing to increase. And we have a lot of irreversible processes. All right, give me a minute. Okay, that's not the only description that there is for entropy. There are other descriptions. The book puts in a paragraph or so about it. But another description you may hear about is that entropy actually measures the amount of disorder there is in the universe. So, for example, if you look at an ice cube, All right, an ice cube goes from a very ordered solid to a liquid. All right, doesn't it? So it has to become more disordered. Okay, lots of things are like that, like your rooms. All right, you can put your room into order, right, without much help. Okay, it completely goes to disorder. Okay, other measures of entropy are information. This is the information age. And so a measure of how much information loss we have is also another way to write down what entropy is. There's quite a bit out there about entropy, and it's a complicated issue once you start getting into these details. All right, so for the most part, those are the laws of thermodynamics. On Monday, I will describe some things about waves. We'll be doing a good part of chapter 16. We're not doing the Doppler effect, and we're only going to talk about standing waves in chapter 17. So I'll tell you about what we're talking about. All right, see you in lab. See you in the